Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, remembering the Shoah, Pope Benedict recalls the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp and says he prays that the memory of the Holocaust will inspire a greater respect for the dignity of every human so as to avoid the repetition of such tragedies. God on trial. On this Holocaust Memorial Day, we talk to the award-winning Catholic writer Frank Boyce, who wrote the screenplay for a TV play that describes how a group of prisoners at the Auschwitz camp put God on trial. And reaching out, we find out why the issue of poverty and social exclusion should be looked at in a new way as Caritas Europa launches its anti-poverty campaign for 2010 at the European Parliament. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict recalled today's 65th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp and called for the memory of the Shoah to inspire a greater respect for the dignity of every human being so as to prevent the repetition of such tragedies. The Pope's appeal came at the end of his Wednesday General Audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Oggi si celebra il giorno della memoria.
On Holocaust Memorial Day, we remember the horror of crimes of unprecedented cruelty committed in the extermination camps established by Nazi Germany, especially the planned annihilation of the Jews, and also how many risked their lives to protect the persecuted, opposing this murderous folly.
L'orrore di crimini di inaudita efferatezza.
The innumerable victims of blind racial and religious hatred who suffered deportation, imprisonment, death in those abhorrent and inhuman places were also remembered Wednesday by Pope Benedict XVI, who prayed that the memory of these facts, particularly the tragedy of the Holocaust that affected the Jewish people, will inspire an increasingly convinced respect for the dignity of every person. He prayed that Almighty God enlighten hearts and minds so that such tragedies never happen again.
Affinché non si ripetano più tali tragedie.
Also present today are pupils and teachers from the Akabat Eilat One More Step Towards Peace Project. A group of high school students is also present from Israel and Jordan.
In remembering the Holocaust, the Pope concluded his general audience Wednesday, delivered in the Paul VI Hall. His catechesis continued his reflection on the life of the Church in the Middle Ages, but this week he dwelt on the figure of a man and a saint who is deeply loved by believers and non-believers worldwide and who still today inspires millions, Saint Francis of Assisi.
The story of Saint Francis' life and conversion and his complete devotion to Christ, poor and suffering, is well known. After gathering a small group of companions and followers, including St. Clare, Francis sought the approval of Pope Innocent III for his movement, which was completely committed to the renewal of the Church in holiness and to the preaching of the gospel.
Another aspect of Franciscan spirituality highlighted Wednesday was the saint as a model in dialogue with Islam. He said in 1219, Francis was allowed to travel to Egypt to meet with the Muslim Sultan Malik El Kamal. In an era where there was a clash between Christianity and Islam, Francis, deliberately armed with only his faith and gentleness, effectively traveled the path of dialogue. Pope Benedict XVI said he is a model that should inspire relations between Christians and Muslims even today to promote a dialogue in truth, in mutual respect, and mutual understanding.
His deep piety found expression in a great devotion to the Eucharist as a sacrament of Christ's real presence, and his love for creation as God's handiwork. The life and teaching of St. Francis has inspired countless people to the imitation of Christ through the embrace of inward and outward poverty.
A giant of holiness, a truly living icon of Christ, St. Francis, concluded Pope Benedict, is also a model for priests and the precursor of a just love for God's creation. I'm Emma McCarthy.
God is not good. Oh, at the beginning, when he repented that he had made human beings and flooded the earth, why? What had they done to deserve annihilation? What could they have done to deserve such wholesale slaughter? What could they have done that was so bad? God is not good.
God on Trial was the name of the TV play that you just heard a clip from, which recounts how a group of prisoners at the Auschwitz concentration camp stage a mock trial of God. The highly acclaimed play wrestles with universal questions about faith, about why there is so much suffering in the world, and what kind of God would allow it to happen, and why. After putting forward many different arguments, the play ends with the prisoners finding God guilty of breaking his covenant with the Jewish people.
Is there any other explanation? What do we see here? His power, his majesty, his might, all these things, but turned against us. He is still God, but not our God. That's what's happened to the covenant. He has made a new covenant with someone else.
Auschwitz was the Nazis' largest concentration camp, where over 1.1 million Jews alone perished. And it was exactly 65 years ago today that the camp was liberated by Soviet troops, many of whom wept when they saw the pitiful state of the survivors. Every year on this date, tens of thousands of different events are held around the world to reflect on the Nazis' extermination of over 6 million Jews and other minorities at Auschwitz and other death camps during the Second World War, and to remember the victims of subsequent genocides, like that of Rwanda. Frank Cottrell Boyce is an award-winning Catholic author and writer in Britain who wrote the screenplay for God on Trial. The idea for the TV play was taken from a book on a similar theme, written by the Nobel Peace Prize winner and Holocaust survivor Eli Wiesel, and was inspired by alleged reports that a group of Auschwitz prisoners had indeed conducted a mock trial against God shortly before being taken to the camp's gas ovens. Boyce said his own faith as a Catholic was severely challenged while reading the Old Testament and doing research before writing the screenplay for God on Trial. He began by telling me how he first got involved with this project.
A producer that I'd worked with for a number of years had always wanted to make this story. It's a story that I've known since I was a teenager, and the basic story is that the rabbis in Auschwitz are supposed or reputed to have put God on trial, and the story is that they find God guilty, and at the end they say, so God is guilty, what do we do now? And they say, let us pray, which is a very kind of neat little story, has the feel of a parable. And I think I always thought it was a true story. Then when I started researching it with Mark, the producer, we couldn't find anyone who'd witnessed it. We couldn't find any more details than that. So I kind of came to the conclusion that it was just a parable, like not like an urban myth, but like a kind of part of the folklore of Auschwitz. But since the film went out, we've had a couple of contacts with people who said that they were there and it did happen. So who knows?
Well, as we all know, it was set inside Auschwitz, the largest concentration camp, which in many ways symbolises the worst of the horrors of the Holocaust. What are your own feelings about the Holocaust, and how did this project change or modify your views on it?
I think we all grow up knowing about the Holocaust, and it's only when you kind of research it in any depth, you start to come across individual stories, and as ever, the more specific you are, the more universal your understanding becomes. It's only by kind of engaging with individual stories that you realise just how horrific it was. So 6 million means nothing to you, but when you read the individual story of a father who's made to choose between his two children, or all those horrible individual stories, that some of which are in the film, that's sort of when it starts to become vivid and it starts to give you nightmares.
And what, in your view, are the continuing consequences of the Nazi Holocaust in our modern times?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I'm not really qualified to answer what the kind of political fallout from the Holocaust is, but I did try to kind of engage in what it meant theologically, because obviously it put the Odyssey and the question of evil very firmly on the agenda for Jews and Christians. And I think one of the things that I've got out of this is a very much renewed sense of the continuities between Judaism and Christianity. For me, it's kind of re-Judaized my Christianity, if you see what I mean.
God on Trial, it asks a lot of universal questions about faith, the existence of God, philosophy, and especially the question, why is there so much suffering in the world and what kind of God would allow it to happen? But there's no real answer to many of these, is there?
No, I mean, it's strange that we're talking in this in the aftermath of the Haitian earthquake, and I was actually writing it not long after the tsunami, and huge kind of natural events tend to put the question of suffering back on the map. There's no intellectual answer to the question of suffering, I don't think, really. I mean, the play kind of rehearses all the possible theological and intellectual answers that we've come up against, that we've ever had. You know, it kind of systematically goes through all of them. They're all kind of unsatisfactory, really, because in the end, it's about faith, and it's about your relationship with God. It's a relationship. It's like a marriage, like a love affair. It has these kind of glitches and unknowns and mysteries in them. And I think in the end, it's about mystery. It's about being able to accept that you don't know everything, can't know everything.
And what about the theological or otherwise arguments that the camp prisoners in Auschwitz used to condemn God?
I mean, that was very tough for me because obviously I didn't really realise it when I took it on, but the whole thrust of the story is that you have to find him guilty. And if you're going to dramatise that, you have to find the clinching argument. You have to find the worst thing that you can possibly say about God. So working on it, it did take me to a very dark place, really. And, you know, I had to read the scriptures. I did sort of take it all very seriously. I read the Torah. I read the Bible from beginning to end. I tried to put myself inside their heads and find out what was the kind of worst thing that you could say about God, which is in the film, and it is a kind of a clinching argument. It had to be very convincing, and that was really hard for me as a Christian to write those lines, you know, to go to the darkest place that you possibly could.
Now, I know you're a Catholic, and as you said, you went to the darkest place, and you're certainly on record as saying that your faith was severely challenged by all this research you did before you wrote this play, and especially by reading certain parts of the Bible. Can you elaborate a bit on how it did challenge your faith?
I now feel very positive about it. When I first started it, the idea of putting God on trial seemed sort of blasphemous and uneasy. And I kind of took it on because I didn't want somebody else doing it. I didn't want, you know, some militant atheist writing this play. I wanted to make sure that God had the best possible counsel for the defence, which in my vanity I thought was me. And I spoke to an academic rabbi, Dan Kohn-Sherbock, who's very distinguished, a brilliant, very helpful, very generous rabbi. And he said, you mustn't be afraid, because in Judaism, we have a very dynamic relationship with God. We challenge and we argue with God all the time. And I realized when I was talking to him that my own prayer life as a Catholic really comes down to please, thank you, and sorry. And that's about it. In all the prayers that I say, that it's either please, thank you, or sorry. Whereas in Judaism, there's a lot of kind of raging. Abraham bargains with God. Even Jesus, you know, is on the cross, is accusing God, why have you forsaken me? And it is a much more kind of energetic relationship. So that's the kind of positive thing I took from it. I think my faith grew like that, really. I mean, on the negative side, just God of the Old Testament is a hard God to love, you know. He's a vengeful, unpredictable, partial character, and it kind of made me appreciate how much we've grown in our understanding of God, really, reading that stuff. But it was quite difficult to read.
When he asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, Abraham should have said no. We should have taught our God the justice that was in our hearts. We should have stood up to him. He is not good. He has simply been strong. He's simply been on our side.
So how in the end were you able to rationalise or overcome these doubts about the nature of God and his humanity and your own faith?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what I said before, that in the end you exhaust all the intellectual arguments, and it's about faith, and it's about a relationship. And I kind of my starting point was really that I did meet Holocaust survivors who had lost their faith, but I also met Holocaust survivors whose faith had grown enormously through what they'd experienced and through what they'd experienced since. And I kind of thought, well, my starting point was like, well, who am I who've experienced nothing but some difficult reading? Who would I be to lose my faith in the comfort of my office if these people literally went to Auschwitz and didn't lose their faith? So that was kind of my starting point. And it is in the end, it's about a relationship. There's a great quote from La Rochefoucauld who said that a small fire is put out by the wind, but a strong fire is made stronger by the wind.
And if you had to sum up, what would you see, at least as far as you were concerned, as the main message of this play? As we said, it didn't answer a lot of unanswerable questions, but what message were you trying to portray?
I think I wanted people to feel the arguments rather than to hear the answer. You know, to kind of experience both the despair and the hope. I mean, there are people in that play who give incredibly strong evidence of the presence of God in the worst circumstances. And I kind of think, well, if you stay open and if your faith stays intact, you will find God in the worst circumstances. And we know from personal experience, don't we, that it's people who've had the hardest time have the strongest faith. You know, that you, if you want to go to find people with great faith, there'll be people at the bedside of their sick child. There'll be people in Haiti today who will have the strongest faith.
So what did the experience as a whole teach you?
Well, I mean, the heritage that I've taken from it personally is I have a much better prayer life. I have a much more dynamic prayer life. I put much more of myself into my prayer. I've learnt that from Judaism, and I suppose that's another strong thing I've taken from it, that I have a much stronger sense of the Jewish roots of my Christian faith.
And how easy is it really to learn from the lessons of the past and ensure that this enormous evil like the Holocaust doesn't occur again?
Well, I mean, as a society, we don't seem to learn any lessons whatsoever. So, I mean, I think one reason for doing a play like this is to keep the memory of the Holocaust alive, because it is the great kind of example of how badly wrong things can go. And people know the fact of the Holocaust, but they don't understand the mechanics of it, that, you know, it took ordinary people to do those jobs. Perfectly ordinary people, you know, manned those camps and manned those ovens. And we need to remember that, you know, that we're all capable of that. It's not something in the German character or the Polish character. It's just something about the nature of power that makes us act like that. And we need to keep reminding ourselves that that can happen, I think.
I was speaking to the Catholic novelist and screenwriter Frank Boyce. Even in today's wealthy Europe, pockets of poverty still exist, where people are blighted by the lack of an adequate income to secure the daily necessities of life. But how many of us see the poor in our midst? And if so, do we try to reach out to them? On January the 27th, Caritas Europa officially launched its 2010 poverty paper at the European Parliament and appealed to people to look at the issue of poverty and social exclusion in a new way. Caritas says poverty shouldn't just be seen as a problem involving a lack of money and material goods for the poor person concerned, but as a phenomenon that affects a person's soul and his or her whole life. It says poverty also affects the entire community where the poor live. In the paper, which is released to coincide with the European Year for Combating Poverty and Social Exclusion, Caritas highlights what poverty policies can do to prevent the spiral of poverty from taking place and calls for the vision of zero poverty in Europe. Ernie Gillen is president of Caritas Europe, and he spoke to me about the findings of their new poverty paper.
Caritas Europa launched this poverty campaign because poverty is simply a scandal. Every human being has the right to sufficient means for a decent life. Nobody should live in poverty because of unjust structures or unfair conditions. Therefore, we are claiming zero poverty.
Now, you say poverty is a scandal. How much has poverty changed in recent years? Are poverty levels more or less stable, or are they going up because of the economic crisis?
You know that poverty is not an objective phenomena. We have to define it within a given society. I just came back from Sudan this morning, and there, of course, you will find a different type of poverty. If you are looking at Haiti, you will find a different type of poverty. If we are looking what is going on in Albania, Moldova, Russia, you have different types of poverty. Then if you are looking at the big cities, London, Paris, Brussels, Rome, there again, you will find another type of poverty. So we have to look at poverty in the different contexts, and that makes it so hard to have a common definition. Nowadays, there is a big discussion in the scientific world, but among politicians as well, should we consider only the extreme poor people as being poor people, or should we really look at people who can't participate in the society? We think that it's important to have a more broad definition and understanding of poverty, because poverty is a multifacial situation, it's a multifacial phenomena. You can be poor because of your health conditions, you can be poor because of your job situation. There are people working, they are called working poor. You can be poor because you have not the good education. So there are a lot of reasons why you can be considered to be a poor person. And the manifestation of that is you can't participate in the society with your full potential. And this means as well that the society is losing a resource. So we have to accept, as Pope Benedict has put it so clearly in Caritas in Veritate, we have to look at people being resources in a society. We can't simply afford to lose the potential of persons in our society. So that's why the society is poor if there are simply people living under their potential in that society.
You talked there, as you say, about people not realising their potential. And I noticed that your paper is called Poverty and Social Exclusion. And is this part of the problem, is that poor people, it's not just, as you say, their physical and material needs, but it's also their emotional and social needs. They're somehow being cut out from society.
You are right. Even an individual person is a homeless person, for example. He is an isolated person. A lot of elderly people are living in homes. They are living in an isolated situation very often. People with disabilities, they are living in a situation of isolation. So you can look at that from a technical point of view, or you can look at it from a moral point of view. And social exclusion, that's not only a technical problem. Technical problem can be solved by the state, by the politicians. But as a society, we do have a moral and a spiritual problem to face. And that's not only the problem of the person being isolated, being alone in that society, but again, it's a matter of the whole society, of the community. And we think that the community can bring a lot of relief to isolated people and really alleviating poverty in a very concrete way, and not with big means. But what you need is a person encountering another person, looking at that other person in a good and a positive way, accepting that person as being a human being.
Looking at Europe, which of course has become much more wealthy over the past decades, I mean, how has the face of poverty changed there? I mean, it must be much less visible than it was. I mean, you don't see people running around barefoot on the streets any longer, which you might have seen, you know, 70 years ago.
Yeah, nevertheless, there are people living in extreme poor conditions in Europe as well. If you go to Albania or if you meet people in Moldova, they are living in very, very poor conditions. So we should not think that today there are no longer extreme poor people living in Europe. There are people fighting to survive in our society. Of course, this extreme poverty is not a major phenomena, but nevertheless, one extreme poor person is one extreme poor person too much.
And what preventative measures can be taken to stop people sliding into poverty? As you said, it's a multifaceted problem.
I really think that what society as such can do is changing its view on poor people. So if we as members of a society meet anywhere in a street, in a cafe, in a restaurant, in a hospital, a poor person, we should act. We are able to act. So it's not delegating that to the state or to the government, but there the society in itself, can become a witness of the love of God, but can become a witness of the citizenship we do share with all the people. So making poverty a concern of all and each one, that's a possibility to make a big change in our own behavior and to prevent poverty right from the beginning.
And what are Caritas's main initiatives in this field? How are you trying to tackle this problem of poverty?
Caritas in Europe is running social services, so a lot of Caritas organizations do provide direct services to homeless people or to children in need or to families in need. Another type of intervention which is very key to Caritas in Europe and Caritas in the world is that we are fighting on a political level as well. It's our duty to convince those in charge that they have to take care about everyone living in this society. And that's our role as an advocate for poor people, as an advocate for a better society.
In your press release, you talk about how poverty affects the person not just in his and her body, but that person's soul and his or her life, and it even affects the community where he or she lives. Can you expand a bit on that?
The community is not something simply given. The community is built every day, every hour, every minute by the people being part of that community. And so if everybody simply is using the community as a resource for himself or herself, this cannot work. So what we need is a concrete building of communities, an effort everyone is trying to strengthen the community. And even poor people can, in that sense, invest some of their energies in that community. So if someone, for example, is begging, then he is inviting the community to react. And we should not look at that situation of begging as being someone who does not belong to that community. That person is giving us an opportunity to integrate that person. And when we are then simply offering money, that's not enough. That person is holding his hand not only to receive money, but to receive eye contact with the giver, to receive relationship. And as Pope Benedict has clearly told us in Deus Caritas Est, charity is not a technique, it's a matter of the heart.
I was speaking to Ernie Gillen, president of Caritas Europe.
That's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.